This is GamesAtWork.biz with Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with. This is episode 228, Dragons and Lightsabers. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Michael Rowe here on a Friday GamesAtWork.biz type day with my friend and co-host Michael Martin.
Woohoo! A little bit of a rainy kind of day, isn't it?
It's a day, like most other days. This Earth rotates around the sun, the moon rotates around the Earth, the sun and the solar system rotates around the galaxy rotates in a circle.
Unless it's not rotating, it could be oscillating.
Then we all fly off the edge.
Yeah. Well, I am super excited about the lineup that we've got for this particular episode, especially because we're starting off with something near and dear to my heart, my Star Wars-infused heart, my ninja and samurai experiences around katanas and lightsabers. So the first article is from Sports Illustrated, and there's been a couple of interesting tweets here of late, where the Fencing Federation in France, say that five times fast,
nope,
is now officially recognizing lightsaber dueling.
And if I remember correctly, you used to do fencing on top of all this.
I did. And
comes back.
It all comes back together. But I did not fence saber. Saber for me was always way too fast. Those bouts were just like clack, clack, done. And
you used a foil?
I was more on the foil side. I didn't do the épée, which I think is actually even – I mean the foil is the most traditional basic one of the three blades.
Uh-huh.
But
curses foiled again.
Spoiled again. This super, super appealed to me because of the way that you would engage and hold the blade and be able to actually have a duel. And so there's a whole point system about striking someone in the torso, or the head, or the leg. And there's a whole series of rules around it that I don't pretend to understand all of them just yet. But it was like, wow. How much fun would this be to actually be engaged in lightsaber dueling with real polycarbonate blades that shoot if they made the noises when they struck one another?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, how cool would that be, huh?
Oh, I thought this was really cool. I mean, and I remember, gosh, it's been, I want to say like 14, 16 years ago, they came out with the really nice sabers, lightsabers that you could buy at like FAO Schwartz and other high-end toy stores that did the vroom, vroom, vroom and had that,
yep,
that blade that lit up correctly and actually made the sound when they would smash into each other.
Right, yes.
So these are just look really, really cool. And like you said, it's lightsabers, which is Star Wars, which is cool. The one question that came to my mind is, would they let you use Darth Maul's saber? So the double-ended saber.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't see that in any of the videos that I've seen so far. So I imagine that there might be something like that, or to have dual lightsabers that you could use, like some of the characters as well. Some of the rules, as I understand it, require that the tip of the blade has to be withdrawn, I think, behind your head after every strike, which is kind of an intriguing thing, too, because as you might use some very traditional Japanese style attacks,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
there are several starting positions that lend themselves extraordinarily well to this kind of a fencing engagement, and some of which then would not necessarily be the beat attacks that you would do would not be such that you would move the tip back behind your head again. And One of the rules that I did remember seeing is that the points would be scored when you're striking with the edge of the blade as opposed to the tip of the blade.
So no that, thrust. It's more of a slash.
Right. Exactly. Which is certainly more of the classic lightsaber duels that you'll remember seeing from the Star Wars films, but it would not be as accurate, I guess is the right word, is that if you were impaled, that would do substantial amounts of damage too.
Yeah, so here's my question. You said behind the head and up. What about, you know, I've seen starting positions where the sword or the saber is held kind of down below behind the waist at an angle. Would that be a valid starting position?
I think it would be, and if the way that I'm interpreting just the little bit of it that I've seen so far, that is a very traditional Japanese starting position.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if you were to have a crash of a blade and then have to circle it behind you and then attack once more, you may not see this actually, Michael, right now, but I'm doing the motions.
I could tell. It's perfect for an audio podcast.
exactly. The one video that I was watching was saying or suggesting that these rules are in place in order to create a more dramatic and exciting bout, and that's a little bit more of the cinematic experience too.
Well, so, speaking of dramatic and exciting, I mean, if you saw the article from Valve and this Beat Saber game, where the guys are just – they're going so fast that they actually had to do an update to Steam VR because the players are just like – and just slicing stuff up in the air. And I'm watching this video, and it's crazy. I mean, it's almost a blur. I kind of guess what's going on, and I'm – only because I can see the kid up in the top right hand of the corner, right, of the window.
Right.
But it's almost like he's playing the drums, right? With no sound on, he looks like he's playing the drums.
That's exactly the kind of body mechanics that I'm seeing here too. So thank you, Ian Ypred, for giving us this particular link to chat about. It is exactly drumming, and when you think about the speed of a even semi-professional drummer, you can get way wicked fast. And this game is intended to be you're wielding two lightsabers, two different colors, and you're having to slice in virtual reality various things that are coming at you. It's a little bit like Fruit Ninja, but not quite.
3D coming at you, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so and you know, when I think of
– just that.
When I think of, you know – incredibly fast drummers. I think of Neil Peart from Rush, who I saw in concert, phenomenal, and Stuart Copeland from The Police, right? Both are just unbelievably incredible drummers. There was an album that Stuart Copeland did shortly after The Police broke up, before he started doing movie soundtracks, that was just all drum music. And I still remember it because I actually reviewed it at the time for the college radio station when I was doing album reviews. And it's just mind-blowing, the speed. And the fact, because of that speed, it's almost like there's more than two sticks, right? Even though you know the guy's playing only with two sticks and a kit.
Right.
But it sounds like there's like 15 people hitting all over the place, right? Just going nuts. That sound is what I'm seeing in the visual in this GIF that's in the article.
Not exactly in the air tonight now, is it?
Or it's so funny. So when I went and saw Rush in concert in college, the next day I had tickets to go see Tony Bennett in concert. Right.
Oh,
and
that's bit of a switch.
So Rush, incredible drum solo. Crowd going nuts. Crazy. The next night, Tony Bennett, the drummer kicks into a drum solo, and I literally laugh out loud because he's doing one of these jazz drums. And I still, when I hear it, that type of jazz drum, I just laugh. So, yes.
Well, you know,
talk about juxtaposition.
Let's stay, though, on the musical theme, shall we, for a little while longer. So we have a link here, which is a new game, another VR game that deals in the music space from Harmonix, rhythm shooter Then this one is called, no, now we're gonna have to pronounce this too, aren't we?
Attica.
Attica?
Attica. Attica.
Maybe that's what it is. Yeah. So in this particular game, the visual imagery is of someone who has got a couple of blasters, a little bit like the drumsticks in the prior game, and you are blasting at targets. And as you hit them, the game plays the music that kind of sort of fits with you hitting the targets.
Oh, at least it doesn't kind of sort of, to me, it hits perfectly. It's like, right? And then you have, right? So you have these different sound beats based off of the size and the shape of the dots floating at you and whether they're strung together or not. Remind me a lot of Guitar Hero, which is harmonics, right? But as someone who's really big into electronic music, this sounds like an incredible show that you would see like one night at Moogfest, right? And speaking of Moogfest, because that'll be coming up again in, gosh, just 2 months now here in North Carolina. They announced yesterday that Martin Gore is going to be one of the key speakers. Now, you might say, who's Martin Gore? And I will have to say, you got it. I was about to say, if you don't know... That's Depeche Mode, man. So Gary Numan, first Moogfest I went to, Depeche Mode, one of the lead guys from Depeche Mode this year, in between Michael Stipe. Incredible, incredible times. But anyway, this game to me looks really fun, and it reminded me of Guitar Hero, and I had totally zoned out when I was first looking at the video that Guitar Hero was harmonics, so it just makes sense.
No. Well, I know that, and that was something that popped right away, and I love Guitar Hero. And it was one of those games that, okay, how do you top Guitar Hero?
Rock Band.
Tops it.
Rock Band.
Well, right. But I'm not sure this one tops Rock Band after Guitar Hero either.
I think this does, because it's the whole VR aspect, right? It's much more immersive. You can see this as like the start of getting into Rock Band for VR, where you become on stage.
I would rather go that route than to be in a spot where you're creating the auditory element by firing blasters. So the firing of blasters could work with tempo and with drum kind of structures, that sort of thing for sure. But it'd be hard to make the nice linkage in with the music the way that Guitar Hero Rock Band did, which was when you hit the notes that were coming at you and you hit them right, then the whole, auditory reward came as a result of that. And even when you were getting it mostly right, you got a good amount of it. So I that aspect of that harmonics series of games is something I really appreciate. And I still actually, now when I hear songs on the radio that I used to play in Rock Band or Guitar Hero, I like them better because I had to work at them to master them,
Yeah. I think we don't see that in this game yet because they're pretty much showing somebody playing, God level and making it perfect. Right. If they showed them failing some, I bet you would have some of that same mechanic going on, especially where he's doing these long runs where he's kind of like doing the whip shoot is the best way in my mind to describe it, to get that run of notes and beats. I've got a feeling that's the case, but we don't know yet because haven't seen this in person.
Well, right. And if the structure is that you're using something that simulates a trigger in addition to a handheld device that you're having to raise and generally aim, then that extra motion there, that would be the part of the thing that would be discontinuous for me.
Yeah.
But I could see where this could turn into something that might attract an interesting Twitch audience to watch people be playing this and play it at a high level and get that degree, of enjoyment after, just watching somebody who's a master at it.
Right. Well, I the other thing that comes to my mind when kind of thinking through this one is we got to realize and remember where we are today at the level of VR gaming capability and the accuracy, the pixel perfectness of you know, aiming, you know, what's the state of the art that the average person's going to have in their gaming room. And you have to make it fun enough, right? If it requires, you know, perfect precision for your blasting, to where the music is never good, then that would be a frustration too. So I think this is an interesting first step. The way I interpret it, it's the start of getting to Rock Band in VR as they learn the mechanics and figure out the graphics and the placement of you know, where the hand devices are, right? You know, how do you do this from a standpoint of, let's say you do the guitar from Guitar Hero. Well, in the plastic guitar you had, you know, the four buttons on the frets and the thumb bar, right? Right. As well as the wah-wah bar, right? So between those, that level of precision's not quite there yet with VR controllers. And if you think about taking it all the way into a full-on VR guitar, you're going to need some kind of sensor on each finger practically in order to get that level. So I think this is a first step into getting there, and I'm excited about it. And like I said, I like the music.
Well, so speaking of looking at how you get to that level of precision, our next article looks like it's doing some of that here right now, just from the graphics and the imagery. There's a company called MetaViz that's been spending the last couple of years developing augmented reality visualization tools for surgeons, and they're now just in the spot of bringing what they have to market. But you could see where this could be incredibly valuable. We've talked about examples like this for a variety of use cases, not just medicine, but auto repair and a whole range of other things as well. What's your takeaway for this?
Well, this one's really interesting. And last week I spent the week at the Industrial Internet Consortium's quarterly meeting. And one of the big things in there is how AR and VR are being used in an industrial environment. And from that perspective, just like the automotive one that you were talking about, a lot of those models exist, right? They exist because you build CAD drawings and models as part of the manufacturing process in order to build the thing that you might need to then use in an AR or a VR overlay in order to do the additional interactions for training or for repair or whatever. In medical and surgical, there's not a perfect model of Michael Martine available in a CAD drawing, right?
No, there should be.
And so this one I find really interesting, and they talk about it some in the article on how do you get that pipeline developed in order to build out all the right modeling so that it's more than just a training tool, but it's really a visualization tool for a surgeon, right? So you've done woodworking, I suppose, at some point in your life, you know,
minimal amounts, you know, planing and whatever.
Yeah,
so.
In elementary school, we had a wood shop class over the summer. Did that a couple of summers, and you know, in scouts, do woodworking, and helping my dad over the years building stuff. One of the things you always talk about is, you know, measure twice, cut once. When you think about in surgery, the ability to really do fine-grained, detailed visualization and measurings, quote-unquote, of a patient and the procedure you're about to perform would be a tremendous value add when it comes to dealing with surgery. So think about this. You've got a patient. They're on the table. They have a blockage in one of the arteries around the heart. Traditionally, you would just take, you know, I'll oversimplify, a wire, right, and scrub it out, right? Or you might do a bypass. Yep. Well, you can do a 3D scan of the heart, and if you could lift that up in front of the surgeon's face so they could get a much better view of how they might approach coming in through a minimally invasive procedure and access that one piece of plaque and pull it off the artery in the heart, this is where I see this tool and this type of platform mm-hmm. going to. Mm-hmm. And that mm-hmm. then becomes much more likely to have that predefined 3D CAD of Michael, right? Based right. off of the types of procedures we know about today. And as we get further along, you know, the ability to do a real-time 3D scan and rendering while the patient is on the table right. through like an open MRI machine or CAT scan or whatever, not one that you get stuck in the tube. This changes the way and improves potentially medical outcomes in surgery and reduces the amount of invasiveness, which again helps patient recovery, blah, 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 blah. I think this is really exciting.
Well, now that I'm on their website, I get a better understanding. And I think your example of measure twice, cut once is exactly what they're after. And the notion here is it's a combination of the augmented reality opportunity to look and see what you're going to do on the particular patient, and a combination with machine learning and artificial intelligence to help guide the efficiency and effectiveness of the surgeon who's actually going to take out the scalpel. And what they say on their website is most medical procedures are performed relatively blindly, with mm-hmm. surgeons having to reconstruct slices of 2D imaging data in the mind's eye to make it actionable.
Yeah, so, it's funny because I hadn't gone to their site yet until you yep. started talking, and I went over to it. And, you know, we've talked about this before. I actually have a 3D printed model of my brain from a scan, right? And I'm looking yep, at the AR scan that they're showing here. And the tool that I use actually gives you all those slices and allows you to turn it into that 3D model. It's just yep. sitting inside of a modeler on my machine instead of, you know, floating in real time right at my eye level while I'm under surgery. I think this is awesome. This makes – I think it really can help improve outcomes, assuming there's not like a software bug.
Well, sure. Sure. And the level of precision that can be done at the individual basis mm-hmm, is really the most intriguing thing, because you might have done this surgery 100 or 1,000 times and you've got that knowledge and experience, but every patient is different, and exactly where that plaque is going to be. Why have a voyage of discovery if you know exactly where it's going to be and you know exactly how to get it with the best health outcomes and the quickest recovery time?
Right? Yeah, well, it's interesting. So much of medicine is based off of averages, mm-hmm. right? There was a story, oh gosh, I think it was on, I can't remember what podcast I was listening to recently, but they were talking about what's the average body temperature. And what is it? What's the number you know?
98.6.
That's what everybody knows, and it's wrong.
Oh, damn.
The instrument that was used when they did the longitudinal study of about 1 million readings to get that yeah. amount was done in the 1800s in Germany, and they used
with mercury thermometers.
That was the under the armpit one. Or something like that.
Ooh,
and uh-huh. depend on where you take it, you get different readings. And since they didn't necessarily recalibrate each time, there's a drift. And the story, I think it was like anywhere between 1 and 3 degrees is kind of the variance on average body temperature. Mm-hmm. That's not calculated. So people go, oh, you got 98.8. You got a temperature. Well, maybe you yep. do, maybe you don't. Right, some people run at 97.6, some at 98.2, right? And because of this, there hasn't yet been enough longitudinal data over a large collection to reestablish what the actual, quote, average body temperature is. So having not the average view of the way a heart should be, but knowing exactly the structure of your heart right before I slice into it is very, very important.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So thinking about this from a game perspective, there was a game I played a while ago called Amateur Surgeon.
Ah, yes.
I don't know if you've ever played that one before, but it was kind of a funny game. It was by the Adult Swim crowd, I think, from Comedy Central. And I just recently saw something like that just come across, that there's like a new version, and they have all kinds of silly tools like chainsaws and stuff like that that you have to use for your operations. I don't know why that sprung to mind. Well, yeah, I kind of do. But
sorry, we need the chainsaw for this guy.
Your health plan provides you with the opportunity for a do-it-yourself surgery. your kid is being delivered by drone now.
Now. Well, speaking
of kids. What if you wanted to go and learn a little bit more about dragons and have some, you know, cool dragon experience? Where would you go for that sort of thing, Michael?
Well, I would probably go to the store number 8 incubator that Walmart is doing, where they're showing off kind of their integrating real world and virtual world experiences. Ultimately, this is a retail experience, but what it is, and what got me excited about seeing the article, was the use of the cave. So, yeah. You know, having that VR cave where you can go in and really experience it. Now, once you see what they go, they actually don't use the cave as a cave. They just use the cave, and the cave is kind of a bubble experience outside where you can go inside, and it has all the video and the sound, et cetera, to give you the fully immersive environment. But they're really using it as just a place where people can go in and put on a VR headset and experience How to Train Your Dragon, which I love those movies. A new one's coming out, I think, this weekend, the third in the series. Yep. So, you know, great tech tie into pop culture. And what they've done is tied in a VR experience to the movie, but also to in-store purchases of cool little dragon figures. And I was trying to remember the it's not Lego Mindstorm, but there was a Lego, not, or was it Lego? It was another tool where you would buy these toys and you would take them home and put them on this certain platform, and that platform then would give them a come alive in a game. Oh, I'm trying to remember the.
Oh yeah, yeah. It was one of the ones that was a platform one. So you would do it with your PlayStation or.
Exactly. So yeah, I can see them taking that and like merging this into like, PlayStation VR, right? Or the Microsoft VR experience, so that you would have a way of taking home the flying experience of How to Train Dragon. I thought it was really cool. It's nice to see this type of stuff coming out of just the what a cool idea, it'll never happen. Walmart does a lot of things in their stores around experimentation. I mean, we know that from a supply chain perspective, all the way to you know, they started doing their own digital streaming services and buy digital content. So this made sense to me, and I just thought it was great because I love How to Train Your Dragon.
Yeah, the videos are kind of fun, and for those of our listeners that are in the United States and happen to be in Nevada, Arizona,
California, Texas,
or Arkansas, you'll get a chance to come to go see this. Yeah, San Bernardino or Anaheim, that's like right now. It's there today in Anaheim.
Well, let's take a flight.
As a recording. Yeah, we're on. How much fun is this?
Yeah,
well,
and
so.
Go ahead.
we're about at our wrap time, and there's an intriguing story that we didn't discuss much in the pre-show, Michael, but you're like, oh, I've got a story here about the emotive headset.
Yeah.
Something
so,
that
I have one of these.
Tell me about it.
Right. So I have an emotive headset. I've got both their headsets.
One of them.
And I worked with these guys years and years ago in a whole nother lifetime. And one of the things we kept talking about was, could you take the emotive headset and use it to rate how people are experiencing a movie? you know, you go to Las Vegas and they're always like, come in here and watch a preview of a new TV show that's going to come out. We're going to have you sit there and turn a dial and say, haha, that's funny, or I'm sad, or I'm happy, or whatever. And so this article is really about a team in France that's been doing interactive films using the Motive headset to understand the experience that the players or the viewers are having in the movie. And they're doing it with a VR headset. It looks like, is that Oculus, I think, in the picture?
It's a Vive.
It's Vive, yeah. Anyway, so they're doing it with a VR experience. VR obviously has much more immersive, is going to cause more sensor, more things to fire in the brain. And I was tying this back to kind of the whole thread of what we've been talking about today of, you know, the lightsaber and the visceral experience of you know, swinging the sword around and then tying that into games and learning and et cetera. And when I first looked at this type of technology and emotive specifically, you and I think, had this conversation. And the thought was, what would happen if you did this for a movie? Well, it can understand at the most base level how your brain is being stimulated based off of what you're seeing. And the emotive headset has things, you know, excitement, boredom, a couple other things. And if you tuned the movie to try to drive maximum excitement and engagement, at the time, we joked and said everything would turn to the most base experience and would turn to horrible, horrible movies because it would just be about tuning your brain to have that most visceral reaction or that most engaged reaction. So I can't read French, unfortunately, and there's a whole detailed French article on what they've experienced with this. But I wanted to get your reaction to what do you think we're ready for that level of movie tuning?
Part of me just kind of scares me for that sort of thing because I don't know that you want to do that. But here's the intriguing further thought, which is, what if you're trying to individualize the movie to the viewer? So if you're trying to create maximum enjoyment and engagement, this sort of a thing would allow you to tailor the audiovisual experience to an audience of one. So that if you and I are both watching the same movie, we're seeing and understanding and experiencing different things because it is concurrently tuned for both of us.
We're watching the exact same movie totally differently.
Yeah.
I love it.
I want to be different just like everybody else.
Yes. Anyway, so that's where my head was going with this one. I thought it was really interesting. I get their mailings, and this was one of the articles they sent out recently. I was like, oh man, they're finally doing what we talked about 12 years ago. So I can't wait to learn French and read the whole article.
Well, you know, if it could be automatically translated for you, so you would get that personalized experience.
Exactly.
So I guess we're starting and ending the show today with our folks from across the pond. So how about that?
Absolutely. Well, really appreciate everybody's feedback and insights over the last few weeks. Sorry we didn't get a show last week. Things just got in the way. And you know, it was great to see ePredator 2 weeks ago at the Industrial Internet Consortium. So that was kind of cool.
Say that five times back.
Mm-hmm. And I think at the same time you were out at the Think Conference, so we were scattered to the winds.
Yep, but we have reconvened and are redoing the things that we needed to do. So thanks for joining, listening in, and I think we'll leave it there for this episode.
See ya. Bye.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.